everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm here with another edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this week is Ed Gorman, a veteran British journalist who, during a 25-year career with the British Times newspaper, was deputy foreign editor, deputy news editor, and a war correspondent before switching gears to cover Formula One and sailing. Ed was instrumental in introducing two British sailing legends, Dame Ellen MacArthur and Sir Ben Ainslie, to the mainstream public, and has reported from a multitude of America's Cups, Olympic regattas, and around the world race stopovers. As well as reporting on the America's Cup and the Sail GP for the Times right now, Ed's latest project is helping the French-centric Imoca 60 class spread its message to the English-speaking world. Ed Gorman, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. It's really great to have you as a guest on the show. I've been hoping to do this for a little while now, and this seemed like an opportune time because we're kind of at a bit of a golden age with sailing, I think, right now, and I want to talk to you about that and get your thoughts on it. Can I start, though, Ed, by just asking you about your love of sailing? Because as much as you are a mainstream journalist and a renowned sailing writer, you're a sailor as well. You love the sport, don't you?
Yeah. Well, Justin, it's great to be here, and you know, thank you for having me. Yeah, as you say, I'm a passionate sailor. I absolutely adore it. I've never tired of the simple thrill of turning the engine off and sheeting on the jib and just feeling that wonderful moment as the wind takes your boat forward. And I still absolutely love sailing whenever I get the chance. I've got a cruising yacht. I think it's my fifth cruising boat that I've had. And I try and get out on the water as much as possible. I actually think, you know, if you're writing about sailing, it's great to remind yourself of what people are dealing with, even if your boat is, you know, mine's a very simple traditional cruising yacht. It doesn't have foils. It's not made of carbon fiber. It doesn't have a swing keel. It doesn't have water ballast. But, you know, I'm sailing what most people are sailing. And, yeah, I love it. And I love the challenge of it. I mean, to me, it's I sail almost entirely on my own because I love it. I love the challenge of being a soloist and the, you know, the way you have to solve all your own problems and you have to assess risk and so on. So I find that very relaxing. It's a great way to get away from everything on land.
So where did your association with sailing come from? Do you come from a sailing family? When did you first sail?
No, I mean, I was brought up in landlocked Warwickshire, which is right in the middle of England. Birmingham is the sort of main area. That's where I was born, actually. And I didn't sail at all. I mean, we went on a couple of holidays to Cornwall, like a lot of people did. You know, we went down the south coast in the 60s, late 60s, and we sailed on a Fairey Falcon dinghy in Falmouth at Mile Hill. And but that was just two summer holidays, and I didn't actually sail until the Times. I was appointed the Ireland correspondent of the Times in 1989, and they sent me to. So I was in Belfast, and actually I went for a drive on my first weekend in Northern Ireland, and I drove along the shores of Strangford Lough, and I saw the Flying 15. They have a really great Flying 15 tradition there. And there was probably 30 boats racing. And I just thought, wow, sailing, I've completely forgotten about sailing. And from that moment, I went out, bought a Flying 15. And then since then, I've had four cruising yachts. And I've had a boat almost continuously ever since.
So you did do some racing. That was my next question, if you'd ever been a racer.
Yeah, I did a little bit of racing, Flying 15 stuff, and then I came back and did quite a bit of Rourke racing, and I raced in the Eora fleet on the East Coast, the East Coast Offshore Racing Association. But actually, I quite quickly realized that I go sailing for de-stressing and for pure relaxation, and I love boats. I love the coast. I love, you know, anchoring in a little creek somewhere. I actually I associate racing more with my work, and although I found it quite tricky because I was often invited onto boats with everyone assuming that I was some sort of Grand Prix sailor, but I'm not. I'm just an ordinary cruising sailor. So I've kept the two things separate, but like any cruising sailor, if I see another boat on the horizon, I immediately start racing it.
quite right too. So a 25 year career with the Times newspaper, I'm guessing based in London, or at least associated with London. Was that always what you wanted from a career? Was that what you wanted to do when you were a kid?
Yeah, well, actually, when I left university, I sort of resolved that I would like to be a journalist. And my interest was always in foreign news and conflict, areas of conflict. So I very early on, I started, took myself off to Pakistan and started reporting the Soviet war in Afghanistan. That was where I kind of really made what name I made for myself in that area. And that kind of led in Fleet Street, you tend to get typecast. You know, if people think that that's what you do, then they keep sending you to all kinds of, you know, so I went to Bosnia and Sarajevo and places like that. Then I did a long stint in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. So, yeah, I mean, those were my formative years. And but actually, I sort of reached a point where I'd had more than enough of that kind of work after about 10 years of it. And actually, I then took the chance to cover sailing, and it was just the perfect contrast. I mean, it couldn't have been a more a better way to sort of recover, if you like.
Yeah, and I think that's when I kind of became aware of you writing about sailing. It was great to have somebody in the mainstream media working on our sport. It's before I was doing anything in terms of media or journalism. I was working in a proper job back then. But I remember you writing a lot about Ellen MacArthur, and I think, you know, Ellen and yourself are kind of synonymous. You broke her a little bit in terms of making the general public aware of it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing about sailing in 1996, which was just at the time that Ellen sort of appeared from nowhere, down on the South Coast, sort of starting to kind of put her name around and sort of saying, you know, I'm this young kid, I've just sailed around Britain and you probably have heard of me. And my plan is I'm going to sail around the world, you know. And I remember meeting her in London with Mark Turner, and she had a sort of file with her, with, you know, all her sponsor contacts. And it was basically a file containing the dream. And I was incredibly lucky to literally be there. You know, I really look back and think I was there right at the beginning. And I sort of really latched onto this. She kind of inspired me, as she did lots of people. I just followed more or less every single step of her career all the way through to the, you know, the round the world record, and then to her retirement. You know, I've, as you say, I've probably written hundreds of pieces about her and felt that I got to know her very well.
So primarily she was a great story at that point, as inspiring as she was, but as a journalist, it's about the story, yeah?
Completely. I mean, she was a great combination, which was that she sort of completely changed the game in terms of reaching out as a sailor. You know, she was touching people that had never really got involved in sailing at all, or even knew much about professional sailing. But at the same time, the real sort of killer combination is that she was putting the results together. And this is what I always say to people, you know, it's a results-driven business in the end. And Ellen was winning or certainly podiuming in all her major races, right up to the Vendée Globe, you know, when she was second. She won the Route du Rhum. I mean, she was, you know, there's nothing like results to get coverage. And then she was just a great community, you know, her emotional intelligence was, I know people sort of, you know, there was quite a lot of piss taking about her crying and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, she was lampooned on various satirical shows. But in a way, that's a mark of her success as a communicator, you know, that people even knew who she was. I mean, it's hard to compare her with any other modern British sailor in terms of her reach.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I remember that sketch show. I can't remember the name of the show, which maybe tells you something, but each week there would be something about Ellen. You know, I just don't think I can make it. And she would burst into tears trying to get across the dance floor in a nightclub or something. And at the time I thought, oh, that's cruel, you know, and they don't understand. And And then I realized that it's a massive mark of respect, really, that that a mainstream TV show sees her as a household name, that everybody's gonna know who this is. And I think ultimately that all just was added to her fame, really.
I mean, for me, it was, you know, I absolutely love solo sailing. I love the challenge of it, which I enjoy myself. But also I love writing about these people. I find them just completely compelling individuals. It amazes me what they're able to do. You know, in a world where sporting greatness can be quite trivial in other sports, but in sailing, you know, it's still an... I know, obviously, things have changed a lot. Navigation systems, self-steering systems, sophistication of boats. But still, you've got to go out there and you've got to, you know, deal with what nature throws at you. And the psychological pressures are immense. And it wasn't just Ellen. You know, I followed, you know, Mike Golding very closely. You know, people like Francis Joyon. I mean, to me, he's just a mega hero. I love the way he goes and does it, sort of the way he wants to. And his career record is astonishing. Actually, I love one story about him I really love is when he broke the solo transatlantic record. I think he got to the Lizard and his team was saying, okay, Francis, you know, we've got the ribs here. Come into Falmouth, you know, let's have a hot meal and get some sleep. And he said, no, I want to get back to Brittany. So he put the helm down and went hammering across the English Channel, you know, probably some huge foam up, and then fell asleep and literally drove his boat straight onto the rocks. I mean, that just, you know, luckily he survived. But I mean, it's just an amazing example of the way his sort of mentality, which is, you know, he's a man of the sea and he had no real, he doesn't have particularly time for sponsors and schedules. You know, I love all that side of it.
Yeah. I mean, these people and the people who've come after it, the Francois Gabars, and they're adventurers as much as anything. Was there anything that you saw when you interviewed all of these people, these solo sailors that were racing around the world, you know, nonstop on their own for weeks at a time? Was there anything that you saw, any traits that were common traits or kind of personality characteristics?
I think they've got uncommon self-belief. I think that's something. You've got to believe in your own ability. You know, you can't, I know a lot of them, obviously there's a tremendous amount of shore support and, you know, in with modern satellite communications, you know, if you've got a problem, you can get on the blower and get people to help you. But the fact of the matter is, as I say before, you've still got to go out and do that. So I think that's one thing you see. I think the other thing is resourcefulness technically. These people are sailors, but they're also plumbers, electricians, sailmakers, structural engineers. You know, they have to learn everything. And I think one of the most impressive things about Ellen is that she's never seems to hit a glass ceiling. She just kept on learning and learning and learning. You know, someone like me, I'm the most, one of my problems sailing on my own is I'm not a technical person. So I need to get someone in to sort something out. But if you're 1,000 miles off Cape Finisterre. So Ellen really impressed me in that way. She just, I think Mark Turner used to say she was like a sponge, you know, you just absorb more and more information and never reach overload. So I think that about them. I think also a lot of them had that kind of humility in the face of the sheer power of nature. And, you know, like all great mariners, they never for a second thought they'd mastered the sea because that's a lifelong task, which is never complete. And I think most of them realize that. Some of them are surprisingly, you know, not particularly imaginative. I mean, Mike Golding's probably, he'd probably admit himself, he's not the most sort of imaginative, creative mind. He doesn't go out there and start writing poetry or singing songs. He just gets the job done. So, I mean, he's a good example of someone with just amazing drive. And that obviously is another key. It's a great, you just need so many qualities. And not many people have it themselves. And I spent a long time writing about these people, thinking that I knew what they were taking on. But actually, I didn't really understand it until I actually tried a bit of solo ocean sailing myself, and that was a real eye opener, I have to say.
Yeah. Now you're saying you tried a little bit of it yourself. Mm. We did a little preparation for this podcast, and we spoke earlier in the week, and you told me something I didn't know, which was that you did a 4,000-mile solo loop in the Atlantic. So this was to find out what you didn't know, right? What you didn't know about solo sailing. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago. I had a Jeannot 389, which is a very nice Mark Lombard design. It's quite a sort of sprightly cruising yacht. And I just thought, look, I've done this for years. I've thought about these people. I've imagined, I've read all their reports from on board. What is it actually like? And what I realized by doing it, I basically did a loop. I went from Falmouth down to Porto Santo and Madeira, then Madeira to the Azores and then back. So it was a three-legged loop. But basically what you don't really understand if you haven't done it is, first of all, the weight of the psychological side of it, which is just to cast off and set sail, knowing that this is what you're going to do. That's incalculable and impossible to imagine unless you actually go and do it. And the next thing was, I suddenly realized when you're out there, it really dawns on you that you're a solo sailor, and everything you do, the mistakes you make, the good things you do, depends on, determines the outcome, whether it's going to be successful or humiliation or disaster. And something as simple as, slicing up a tomato to make a sandwich. And if you, as the boat heels one side or the other and you slice into your forefinger, that could end up being something that could stop you. You could end up becoming heavily infected and then, who knows? So I really understood something that I'd seen with Ellen, actually, where Ellen was quite famous for, in my mind anyway, she was quite famous for going the long way around a problem. So for example, take a very simple example, jibing in 30 knots of wind, actually she might go all the way up to weather and go about just to be sure that she's not going to wreck her rig or something's going to go wrong in a violent moment. And I completely understood that when you're out on your own, it's a few minutes extra, but it's all about preserving the boat and being within yourself. But also I saw the other thing is, and this sounds like a real cliche, but if you go out on your own, you realize just how vast the ocean is, and you've got to go and do it to realize that. And I guess the last thing I discovered is what it's like to sleep alone on board while sailing. And I actually, that was the thing I was probably most interested about, how I would get on with it. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the fact that after a while, I had good AIS system with alarms and so on. And I felt very confident in the technology. And I love that sensation of waking up, going back into the cockpit and sort of talking to my boat, like, what's going on? How are we doing? And the boat would be, trucking along. It was fantastic.
Was there ever a time on that trip where you were lonely, you were tired of being on your own, or did you enjoy the solitude of it?
No, I enjoyed the solitude. That wasn't a problem. I was always busy. I think a lot of solo sailors are the same. There's always something that you want to be doing or looking at or checking or whatever. The real issue I had was actually a very mundane thing, was with battery power, which was because I didn't have a wind vane system. I was using a hydraulic autopilot, which is a very nice system. But I had problems with batteries, and that I had to actually restart twice from the Azores on my last 1,000-mile leg back. And that kind of the second time I'd sailed something like 350 miles down the track and had to go back again. And that I found that psychologically quite tough. I think when you're on your own, it's very easy. I think trying to stay level is the real issue. It's very easy to be ecstatic and euphoric at one moment and then allow yourself to swing down and become really black in another mood, get really depressed. So I think that one of the secrets of the successful people in this area is the ones who are able to keep their mood nice and level. And so for me, it was a great chance to try and really understand what these people do, and my admiration and respect for them only probably doubled, I think, as a result of doing that. I came back and I said that to Mike Golding, actually. Just when I think back to what you've done, I now have such a better idea of what you took on.
Do you think it makes you a better writer for having done that trip when you're writing about these people?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, actually, I haven't had a real chance to kind of use it yet, because I think we're probably waiting. It's interesting, you know, in the newspaper, it's very newsy, and it, you know, I probably need to write a slightly more long-form thing about it, I think. But it's difficult to write interestingly about solo sailing because it's only you and the boat. And that is a real challenge. It's a bit like the inside of a proverbial ping pong ball. It's not an easy thing to do. And I have toyed with it, but I think it'll take quite a lot of work.
That's the curse of the onboard reporter, isn't it?
Yeah,
It seems like the best media job in the world if you're a sailor.
Yeah.
But day after day, it's pretty much the same things happening on the boat. So, yeah, I admire the guys who've done it and done it well. So, Ed, I wanted to ask you about working at the Times back then and being able to report on sailing. Seems to me like the kind of dream job. But was it a struggle to get sailing stories into the paper? Because I remember, you know, Bob Fisher being at America's Cups with Bob Fisher, and he would say, well, I've written, you know, I filed my copy, but it won't go in because it's the European Cup final tonight and, you know, it's all going to be football. But, you know, you were the sailing correspondent. Did that make it easier, the fact that they had a sailing correspondent?
Yeah, well, so we're talking 96 to 2006. So in those days, the Times was a broadsheet, you know, a big scale paper that the Telegraph still is. And they there was plenty of room. And what's more, they sent me all over the place. I went all over the world. I used to go to Whitbread stopovers. I'd go to not just to Olympic regattas. I'd go to the whole Olympic build-up regattas. You know, I would go to, you know, round the world race finishes and starts, America's Cup, New Zealand, that sort of thing. I mean, I've filled cuttings books with it. I mean, and it's amazing when you look back, because I think when I stopped, the paper went to its smaller format, and they sort of told their readers that, you know, nothing would be lost. But frankly, what, you know, in sport, for example, a lot of the minor sports were lost, or certainly the level of coverage was dropped down. It's coming back now because of the online capacity, I think. It's quite interesting how it's now resurgent. I had an amazing time. I took it very seriously, I have to say. I know everyone sort of says, oh, you know, it must have been the dream job, and it was. But I used to really work hard at it. I felt it was important to try and do a really, you know, try and do a proper job and treat the sport seriously. And it was a great time. You know, there were some amazing characters, some fantastic stories, and, I loved it.
Did you have opposite numbers at, you know, say the New York Times or the, you know, the Telegraph, the Guardian, the BBC, people that, you know, were mainstream?
Yeah.
Mainstream,
well,
news
the main
outlets.
Was the the so-called knitting circle, as it used to be known, which was myself, Bob Fisher, as you mentioned, at the Guardian, the late great Bob Fisher, Tim Jeffrey at the Telegraph, and Stuart Alexander at the Independent. So we were the kind of four. A sort of quartet who used to turn up all over the place. And I always remember Bob. When I first met Bob, I was actually quite frightened of him. I thought, oh, Christ.
Me too.
He was quite an intimidating character. And I remember sitting in the press room at Cowes Week before I started. I was just sort of doing a little recce. And he was absolutely going off on one at something or other. He was furious with the people who were organising the press coverage or the press boats or something. And I thought, oh, God, this guy's going to be a nightmare. But actually, he was incredibly helpful. And partly out of self-interest, his view was, you know, the more I got in the Times, the easier it would be for him to get stuff in the Guardian. So he could see the benefit of having, you know, good coverage in his rival newspapers.
Yeah, interesting. Now, you mentioned the Olympics, and I know that you very early on in his career developed a relationship with Ben Ainslie. Obviously, you're a British reporter reporting on a prominent British sailor. That's another individual you've watched kind of evolve and helped kind of publicize their career. I guess he's changed quite a lot from the, what would he be in his teenage years when you first met him?
Yeah, I mean, I remember meeting him at the boat show at Olympia when he was 18 or 19, and he was painfully shy at that age. His whole career was in front of him. I went out to Savannah to the, what was the Atlanta Olympics, where he made his debut, where he won his only medal. It wasn't a gold, where he won silver. And he had this sort of, there was this big moment with him and Robert Scheidt at the last, on the last race, which basically settled the top two positions. But yeah, I followed Ben, you know, because then, you know, he went on to Sydney and Athens, and, you know, we suddenly realized that this guy was someone, you know, completely different class. And he was a fascinating subject because, as I say, he was very shy to start with. But you gradually realize that actually on the race course, there was a completely different personality. He was aggressive. He was quite intimidating. He could be very, you know, loud. And, you know, and the other thing he did was Ben has always taken the game to its absolute limits. You know, he would nearly always leave a regatta with, well, not nearly always, but he would often lead a regatta with just one warning less than a DSQ. So he would, right. He was always looking to, you know, which is how you win. I mean, you've got to take everything you can. And then the interesting thing is to see how he developed as a person, because, you know, gradually these two personalities, this very withdrawn individual on land and this sort of out, accomplished, confident person on the water, gradually these two have come into balance. And we've now seen Ben is now a very accomplished, really figurehead for British sailing, I think. I mean, he is our, you know, he's our leading guy, and he really knows how to articulate well what he's doing, and I think he's proved very good at understanding the context of what he's doing. I thought it was very impressive actually the last cup. You know, he completely realized that they were doing this during COVID and, you know, dealt with some quite tricky territory really well. But I suspect you might want, you were going to ask maybe about his father Roddy, which is actually was the key to my real understanding. So I got to know Roddy very well, Roddy and Sue, his mother, who, like a lot of Olympic parents, if you like, spent years driving around the world, you know, taking boats to regattas and, you know, looking after Ben and supporting him. And I got to know Roddy, and we actually sailed together once on my old crew. I had a classic 35-footer called Nutcracker. And Roddy lived down in Falmouth, and I was sailing from Falmouth up to the west coast of Scotland. And I asked him if he'd join me, and we did a 3-day cruise up the Irish Sea together. And actually, that's when I really realized something about Ben then, that the steel in Ben, because there is real steel in him. And a lot of that comes from Roddy, who was a really strong character. He'd skip at a boat in the first Whitbread race. He was great to be with on the sea. He didn't stand for any nonsense, you know. I'm sure he never pushed Ben to do things he didn't want to do. But on the other hand, I can imagine them standing on the breakwater on the harbour side somewhere on a blowy day. They're kind of wondering, do we go out? Of course you go out. You know, this is sailing, boy. You know, you're going to go out there. And I felt that I understood something about Ben after that trip with Roddy that I hadn't really grasped until then.
Yeah, and Ben is, it'd be easy to call it Jekyll and Hyde with Ben, this kind of mild-mannered personality, almost, still almost a little bit bashful and shy. And then the grit and determination we've seen in the Olympics and the America's Cup, and we've seen it boil over, the diving out of the boat incident down in Australia. But it's not Jekyll and Hyde really, is it? It's more of a, I think it's a conscious personality shift that he makes as a professional sports person. It's the mode that he goes into.
I totally agree. I mean, Ben is quite sort of, he's a logical thinker, and he identifies clearly what he thinks he needs to do to be successful. And at some point, he targeted communication, onshore communication. And he sort of said to himself, I need to master this. So I think he went away, got training, and he mastered it. And there was a kind of weird time where he was still very shy, but if he had a microphone in his hand, he was suddenly like a sort of, you know, he was like a radio DJ. And I was like, wow, what's going on? And then, you know, so we've seen all these things gradually come into line. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Ben is very specific about targeting areas of weakness and then achieving what he needs to in that area.
Now, we'll come back to Ben a little later on because we'll talk about the America's Cup. But I wanted to just go back to what I said at the beginning. It feels to me like, despite all of the COVID problems the world's had, that the one sport that is thriving is ocean racing right now, particularly in France. It is like a real renaissance that's going on. That the guys who run the Tip and Shaft newsletter, you know, they wrote a great piece about the fact that in Lorient and that area around it, you know, you can't get enough qualified people to work on the projects, the boat builders and the technicians. There's a shortage of it. What do you think's driven that? Because you're close to it. You're working with the Imoca class at the moment, and you're kind of immersed in it. What do you see?
Well, I see exactly what you're. I mean, I just think it's absolutely amazing what's going on there. I was in Lorient the other day at La Basse. I always get a bit transfixed by the Second World War when I'm there because you see these incredible submarine pens. They're just mind-blowing structures. But, you know, they're all, you know, a lot of them are now being used for this space age sailing, as you say, golden age of sailing. And it's just phenomenal how many new boats are coming along, how many sponsors are involved, how many, as you say, the whole industry behind it, the kind of the support side of it is enormous. Why has it happened? I've thought a lot about this. You know, why has it happened in France and why is it not happening in the UK? And I still don't really know the answer. You know, we had Chichester, we had Knox Johnson, we had Che Blythe, we had everybody. They had Tabally and they had Moitissier. But Tabally seems to have resonated in a way that none of our guys seem to have done. And I think it might be, this is a really tricky sociological issue, but I think it's something to do with the background, the respective backgrounds of everybody, and the perception in Britain that sailing was somehow something to do with the upper class or something, and wasn't a working class sport or wasn't something for the masses. Whereas in France, I feel that it hasn't had that feeling. French society is structured in a very different way anyway. And sailing has just become something that everyone can associate with. And you see this in the broad spectrum of companies that are doing everything from making biscuits to insurance, healthcare product, you know, anything. They want to be involved with sailing. And I think the pandemic period was quite interesting because sailing was able to get out on the ocean and do something while everyone was at home. And I think a lot of the Vendée Globe sailors, especially, for example, Sam Davis, who I was discussing with the other day about this, she's really noticed the uptick in general interest in sailing in France, even above what it already was, which is huge. Because it had a very prominent position in the sporting world at that time. And I think they made the most of it. And, you know, Imoca at the moment I find it mind-blowing. I mean, I think we will look back and I don't know when it'll start declining, but there will come a time when people look back in the second decade of this century, second and third decades, and say, wow, that was an amazing time.
We had a lot of new boats for the last Vendée Globe,
yeah.
And it feels like the next one's 2024. It feels like the race is almost starting now because we're hearing constantly about people having their sponsorships renewed, new boats being built. There's just a whole buzz around the whole thing already. I mean, it's going to be hard to maintain it, I think, from a media point of view.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think there's something like 8 or 10 new builds going on. There are great sailors coming into the class. There are, you know, there is some new blood, but there's a lot of established stars who've still got work to do, still got points to prove. The class is internationalizing quite a bit. I think that's very important to them. They're trying to sort of broaden the reach of IMOCA. So, we all know it's been massively dominated by the French. And we still haven't seen a non-French winner of the Vendée Globe. I think that would be a really big moment in the class. I mean, my only sort of anxiety about it all is that the boats are getting, you know, they are seriously massively expensive. And we're talking 5 million, 6 million euros to just, you know, put something on the water. They are incredibly complex now. And they're also seriously unpleasant things to sail on in any kind of seaway. And you kind of wonder eventually whether this is going to reach some kind of moment where it all goes into retreat a little bit. So I don't know. You know, foiling has obviously been a huge revolution, and I think that's what we're seeing working through at the moment. You know, there's big steps with every new iteration. And, when we get to the point where the foiling game has been maximized, you think, well, what could possibly come next, you know?
And there was a moment in that last race where everybody said, ooh, you know, maybe the new boats went a bit too extreme with the foils, because we saw the eventual winner on an older boat with smaller, more manageable foils that just over the course of the race was able to do a better job of optimizing speed for the whole thing. And I interviewed Charlie Dallin before the race, and he said, I talked about his involvement in designing the boat. He's a naval architect himself. And he said, when I saw for the first time the size of the foils, I was very happy that I'd had so much involvement in the interior of the boat and making it something that I could survive in. And I think he was shocked when he saw it in real life.
I think Dallin's a very interesting character, and it feels to me like it's no accident that he's risen to the top. I mean, he is the dominant skipper at the moment. He's the man to follow. And I think in the Transat Jacques Vabre, which is just about to start, him and Paul Meyer will be the reference. I mean, those are the guys that everyone wants to beat. But I think, as you mentioned, you know, he's got a naval architecture degree from Southampton. And then he's got this tie-up with Meyer Concept and the Francois Gabart team. And you just sort of feel that this now it's not just a game about being a great sailor and being competitive, being uncommonly competitive, which he is. It's so much about understanding what your choices are when it comes to the design of the, you know, there's so many parameters. You know, although some parts of the boats are fixed, there's plenty of stuff that you can get wrong. And, when I actually sailed with him the other day, and he was saying, you know, he kept referencing the work they did, the huge amount of work that we did before a single part of the carbon laminate was laid down. You know, it was just kind of understanding. And I think that's really, it's a bit like Formula One drivers who understand what's under the bonnet. It helps enormously. And in terms of being able to bring that influence to a team and to turn it into a winning thing.
And how would you compare him, who, as you say, I think is the guy in the ascendancy right now, with somebody like Mitch Dez in his day? Are they very different personalities, or are a lot of similarities?
I couldn't really put my hand on the heart and say that I really know Mitch Dez very well. I kind of know him from afar. I think he's quite a complex personality. I think he's an absolutely outstanding sailor. His record is astonishing. I think Charlie Dallin's probably a slightly more outgoing, probably a bit more easygoing type of character. I think they're both very, very competitive sailors who, and both of them had the ability to hit the right line between pushing their boat and saving their boat. I think that in a way, that's one of the great strengths of Charlie Dunnan. He seems to be able to go fast, but not damage his boat. And that in this class at the moment, that is a preeminent quality. If you're able to push them hard, but not break them, because they're so fragile. And so I imagine, you know, it would be interesting to do it, to study them and see really where the points of comparison are. But I would imagine that's probably it. I think they're both probably very good on the weather as well. I think, you know, both pretty good meteorologists, which is another key skill in this class. So.
Yeah, Charlie was a guest on the podcast, and you're right. He talked a lot about the preparation and making sure that, you know, the limiting factor wasn't the boat as much as they could. And he also talked about how frustrating it was when they had the problem with the, and I'm saying they, meaning the bigger team, had the problem with the foil that he had to repair, and just how close he was to not getting that job done. You know, it was going dark. He's swinging around on a halyard, getting very frustrated, and he knew he had one more go at this to get whatever piece in place before it went dark. Otherwise, it wasn't going to get done. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the race, he said, I'm just so sick of fixing this boat. You know, so even with all of that preparation, this race is so brutal on the boat and the skippers, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one part of it, which, you know, I think we've, as I mentioned before, almost from the first day they set off, the skippers are not really, you know, they never drive the boats ever. Mm-hmm. The pilots are so sophisticated that they can, you know, I'm sure they, I think we all can see that they can sail the boat better than any human can. And, you know, the number of ways they can set the boat up to respond to changing wind angles and conditions and so on. So for most of them, from very early on, they're actually doing something else, which is, you know, something's broken, or they don't understand why something isn't working, and or they suspect, you know. And then as the Vendée Globe typically goes on, these problems just get worse and worse and worse, and they just spend more and more time fixing. And you know, I guess as a sports journalist, I think the one area that is slightly worrying is that the automation levels are so sophisticated. But after a while, you're sort of wondering, you know, what is the sailor actually doing? You know, and, you know, even if he or she hasn't got things to mend, the boats more or less sail themselves, you know. So you kind of wonder whether it'd be nice to go back a bit in some of that. But, you know, it's hard to say how that.
Yeah. And I guess that brings up a point about the sport of sailing, which, you know, you and I grew up sailing sailboats, and you know, I always thought, well, from a dinghy to an offshore racing boat, the physics is the same. There's a rudder, there's something that stops it going sideways, and there's sails. But across the sport now, it's become so diverse, hasn't it? We've got foiling monohulls in the America's Cup. We've got semi-foiling ocean-going trimarans. We've got foiling monohulls, semi-foiling monohulls in the Amoca class. It's almost like the sport is broken up into these segments, which are almost sub-sports on their own. You can't just say, oh, this is sailing.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I don't want to be put down as a traditionalist in inverted commas, but, you know, I still love displacement sailing, or whatever you call it, traditional, you know, a boat that's in the water rather than flying above it. I mean, I can see the appeal of the foiling world, and you know, the AC75s are astonishing, as are the SailGP cats as well. You know, they're phenomenal. But you know, something like the Etchells Worlds, that's still an Everest achievement. If you know, and also to see crews practicing the traditional art. I mean, you know, now referring to them as traditional arts of changing sails. Using downwind sails and, you know, foredeck work and, you know, all those amazing, you know, you see in the 52 class, the FAR 52s, I mean, those guys, the TB52s, they are, aren't they? I mean, the team coordination, those quantum racing videos are absolutely amazing. I mean, that, you know, that's like world-class rugby. You know, those guys know exactly what they're doing at each moment. And that, a lot of that's been slightly lost in the kind of rush for flying. So I certainly, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing the America's Cup take a step back at some point in the future, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. I just feel that that's probably a very difficult thing to imagine. But I certainly still absolutely love and admire the parts of the sport that are in the water.
Yeah, well, I mean, interestingly, if you ask any of the pros, the ones who are maybe not racing America's Cup anymore, but are still working on the pro circuit, the TP52s and the RC44s, it's the RC44 class that they love. That's what the pros love to sail. Yeah. They love those boats because, you know, literally it's all of the things you've described. It's an extremely wet boat, extremely physical. There's not an awful lot of refinement on those boats, to be honest with you. I mean, they look great and they're great to watch. And yet that class doesn't attract a lot of attention. People don't seem to flock to follow that class. It's a bit of a kind of exclusive little niche game being played by, you know, some rich owner drivers.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I still, you know, I look back to the America's Cups of old, when you would wait for that first cross, and, you know, it was all being played out what now seems to be in a kind of painfully slow way, but actually it was no less exciting for it. And I think one of the things that guys who are kind of innovating in the sport quite often forget is that speed itself is just a relative thing. So if the boats are going at 50 knots, then both, let's say in an America's Cup match, they're both going at 50 knots. So very quickly, as a viewer, you discount it because that's the speed they're going. And if they're going at 9 knots, again, you discount it and that's the speed they're going. And I think speed itself, this hunt for speed, everyone assumes it equals excitement, but that equation isn't quite right. It doesn't necessarily. Yeah. You know, one of the most exciting things was seeing Alinghi and Team New Zealand, you know, on the start line. And as we now would say, very ponderously, you know, going up the first beat and coming to that first cross and seeing that one boat was sailing higher and faster than the other. I mean, it was just amazing. It was like, and then seeing how that whole relationship between the two crews played out over 5 races. And, you know, I loved all that. And I completely understand why, you know, a lot of sailors still think that way. And of course, almost all of us are still in those boats. You know, I mean, I don't know anyone who's got a cruising yacht with foils at the moment. I don't know anyone who's got a cruising yacht with a swing keel, even. I don't think I know anyone with a cruising yacht with water ballast. So, I mean, there's this kind of widening gap between what all of us, are, you know, the vast majority of people who love sailing are doing and what the very top elite creme de la creme are doing. It's almost a difference between Formula One and not just rallying, but Formula One and road cars, I'd say.
Now, you bring up motorsport, and you covered motorsport for the Times. You've covered sailing for the Times and the America's Cup. With America's Cup and more recently Sail GP, we've heard this constant, it's like Formula One on the water. I got as tired of that as I did of the Ocean Race, the Volvo Ocean Races. You know, it's my personal Everest, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It just becomes a real cliche. However, we are now seeing some parallels, some links between Formula One and the America's Cup, for sure. You and I were both at the Mercedes headquarters in Brackley when Ben Ainslie announced his partnership, and it's more than just a partnership with Mercedes. We're also hearing about Red Bull potentially partnering with Alinghi if they put a challenge in, and, you know, supposedly the Italians are talking to Ferrari. Is this the way it's going, and is this a good thing, Ed, do you think? Because you've been to that base in Brackley many times. You told me that it was a little strange to be there talking about sailing.
Yeah, I mean, that was old Honda and then Mercedes, yeah. I mean, you you know, Formula One brings together incredible amounts of brain power, design, ingenuity, technical expertise, innovation in technology, all of those sort of things are all there. And you do feel sometimes that there's just way more capacity than they can actually pour into one single car every year. And I remember when I was doing Formula One, which was 06 to 2010, there was always quite a lot of talk about America's Cup. Adrian Newey, the chief designer at Red Bull, has always been very interested in it and was always saying, you know, one of these days I'm going to go and design an America's Cup yacht. And, you know, it was quite an intriguing idea. So I quite like the idea of it, the kind of synergy, which is a, you know, current term that everyone loves, cross-fertilization, that sort of thing. But I have to say I was slightly surprised that Ben and Ineos have gone 2 feet in so deeply into this. I thought they would probably retain a separate identity. But what we really saw back the other day was the complete joining together of those two teams. And actually Ben's main design effort now has moved to Northamptonshire, that well-known seaside area of central England. You know, so it's very interesting. And I guess it'll be interesting to see how the balance of thinking works out between the people who naturally think first about a boat and those who naturally first think about a car, and you know how you can control those elements. I think Jim Ratcliffe's got a lot to do with this. You know, he's as I'm sure many of our listeners know, you know, he's a third shareholder in Mercedes, and he loves the idea of these different disparate elements coming together under his sort of ownership, if you like. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it works out. And I'm not surprised because, you know, I think Mercedes told us that they had quite a lot of spare people and they didn't want to let them go. And actually the sailing option, developing a sailing wing, is a good way to retain, you know, some of these people that otherwise would have been let go.
Because of the cost capping that they've put in with Formula One, which gets even more stringent over the next couple of seasons, as I learned on that day talking to some of the motorsports people that were there. On a personal level, you know, we talked about you knowing Ben when he was 18 as the shy teenager, and you explained this evolution that you saw, but it must have been strange for you to see him looking so kind of calm and composed in this high level motorsports world, sitting with Toto Wolff and the other senior guys from that team.
Yeah, I mean, when you think back to the boat show in 1996 and now to see where he's traveled to, it really is impressive. But I mean, I think we all feel, and I'm sure he does as well, this is it. You know, he's never going to have a better sponsor. I mean, Jim Ratcliffe is the dream. I mean, there are issues around Ineos and what they do and how they make their money, and I'm fully aware of those. But on the simple level of how much money Ben's got to spend, how complicated it is, which is not complicated at all because it's just one single person, you know, he couldn't be in a better position. And, you know, he's had two goes at the Cup, and in both cases, his boat wasn't quick enough. Simple as that. I don't think anybody doubts that Ben and his sailing team are competitive, you know, are up there. And I think if Giles Scott takes over on the driving eventually, you know, that's going to be very strong. So, you know, again, it's very similar to Formula One. You've got to have the car. You know, there are very few drivers in Formula One who can win races in inferior cars. That's one thing they've always said about Lewis. He can take a car by the scruff of the neck and get it onto the podium. I think in sailing, it's much harder to do that. I think if your boat isn't quick enough or it doesn't respond as well in different conditions, which is what happened earlier this year, you're not going to win. So, Ben, I mean, we both sat at that press conference. There was a lot of razzmatazz. You know, Toto Wolff was there. Dave Brailsford was there. Michael Grade was there. There were all kinds of people. But all I was thinking about was solely, I was just thinking Martin Fisher, the new designer they've taken from Luna Rossa. Is he and the group of people he's going to lead, are they going to do what's not been achieved so far, which is to build the fastest boat? And I, at the moment, you've got to think that Dan Bernasconi at Team New Zealand is the man. And I know Ben would love to have, you know, he's an Englishman from my home county of Warwickshire, believe it or not, it's bizarre. And I know for a fact that Ben would love to have had him on the team, but there's no way that Bernasconi is leaving New Zealand. He's now become a Kiwi citizen. He's completely committed out there. And they know exactly how special he is. And it's not all about him, obviously. It's a team effort, and there's no doubt about that. But there's a level at which he's operating. I think the way they're bringing in AI and stuff, and as I say, I have kind of talked to Ben about this, and you know where he would want to have gone. So the question is, can they, with what they've got, have they got enough to bring together, to put together a boat that can win? And obviously we're going to find that out. But that's more or less, I think if you clear all the razzmatazz away and all the synergy and the cross-fertilization, it's going to come down to design.
Is this now setting the standard for an America's Cup team that wants to be competitive, that, you know, you've got to have a Formula One team?
I think I mentioned to you the other day, it'd be great to see the America's Cup in Contessa 32s one day, just to really, really put these guys back into the hot seat and say, okay, just, you know, drive this boat upwind, let's see how you go. And, you know, absolute one design. It would be amazing. I mean, nowadays...
Perhaps we could do that. So whoever wins it next time, they have to rerun the whole thing, but in Contessa 32s afterwards. Well, so you've won the America's Cup, but let's find out whether you really are good enough.
Yeah, well, it really underlines, you know, one of the biggest problems the America's Cup's got, which is barrier to entry. I mean, it's just so expensive. And, you know, not only they've got to do an America's Cup, a male America's Cup team, they've got to do a female America's Cup team, a youth America's Cup team. You know, and as you say, it now looks like you've got to be teamed up with a Formula One team, for God's sake. I mean, this is really becoming becoming exclusively the playground of the most wealthy billionaires. And that's a real pity, because I think everyone wants to see more boats. And Ben for sure said, you know, we'd love to have 10 challengers, which is, you know, what we've seen in the past. But it's looking very, very difficult to get to that.
Yeah, for sure. I don't see any more than we had last time personally, but that's, you know, I'd love to be proved wrong on all of that. I wanted to pick your brains a bit about the last America's Cup. You kind of returned to working for the Times to cover it. They called you up. They didn't fly you down to New Zealand because none of us could get in, basically. Yeah. But you, like me, covered it remotely. We were on Zoom calls at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. What was your kind of overall impression of that? Because I know you said to me earlier in the week when we were prepping this podcast that you'd kind of missed out on the foiling bit of America's Cup along the way. You'd been away from it in terms of reporting on it. So what did you think?
Well, actually, for me, it was quite scary because I'd been away for 2006, so long, 14 years. I hadn't really been looking at the sport at all. And because I tend to be very focused, you know, I'd moved on to foreign news and all sorts of other things. And so suddenly there we were in these foiling boats, and I'd looked a little bit at the AC75 class when it was first sort of launched by Team New Zealand in graphic form. And I was probably I'm an extremely untechnical mind, but even to my mind, I could see this looked like a real stretch. So I was pretty amazed when I started to see these boats doing their strutting their stuff on the Hauraki Gulf. I think as you would have found, it was difficult to cover this from so far away, because actually it's not so much covering the racing, which you probably would have done from the press centre anyway, like you do in Formula One. You sit in the media room and watch it on TV because you can't be anywhere. The real sort of menu that you consume as a journalist at the America's Cup is what happens in the coffee shops and that chance conversation when you're walking into a team base with someone who just sort of makes a remark and you think, that's interesting. And you know, all the kind of impressions that you build up. I always remember once turning up in Auckland when Team New Zealand lost the cup. And I remember arriving there and I remember going to the press room and asking for their media pack. And it wasn't ready. And I was like, what? Your press pack's not ready. And we were just days away from the start of the cup. And I remember thinking, wow, if their press pack's not ready, I wonder what their sail program's like, or their structural engineering program's like, or their crew training. You know, it just suddenly, you know, they're tiny little things. Because Bob Fisher always taught me that the way to cover the America's Cup is with your gut. He just said, you know, none of us are going to really understand the technical side of it until they explain it to us, which will only happen afterwards when it's too late. So for most of the time, you just got to look at what you're seeing, and what your gut tells you will probably be right. And he is at, you know, on that, Bob was absolutely dead right. And he'd seen more America's Cup racing than anyone else. I think the other thing that I found difficult to keep pace with from a village in West Sussex was that we were seeing this pioneering revolutionary class of monohulls, and the rate of development in them that was going on during the cup itself was phenomenal. So the form book, you know, as journalists, we're always trying to write the form book, and everyone's always asking us who's going to win, you know, and, you know, but actually it was changing all the time. Because they were taking big leaps and the class was immature in that way. So it was really tricky to keep pace again from a distance on what was really going on. You know, the American Magic Boat had attributes as fantastic. It was a fantastic package. You know, all came to a disastrous end. And our, you know, the British boat was up and then down, you know. I mean, I think it was a very difficult cup to cover in that way.
There were plenty of stories, but yeah, it was difficult. It was difficult to write anything unique from sitting here in the UK. So hopefully we won't have to do that on the next cup, which brings me on to the next cup. What's your feeling on the whole thing? I know you have some concerns that things are starting to slip.
Yeah, well, I am, you know. I think when the last cup finished, there was a lot of hope that there could even be something in 2022 in the Solent. You know, we all at the Times got very excited about that. and then that kind of, I think that rumor got a bit out of control and it was squashed. And then 2024 has been the kind of accepted target date. But I think all of us are starting to get a bit anxious that 2024 might now be... Yeah, might be slipping. I'm actually quite surprised in a way how chaotic this venue selection and calendar selection process has been with Team New Zealand. I sort of kind of believe all the kind of the hype, really, that they're just, you know, they operate on a different level. But on this, they're not operating on a different level. They're operating on a very ordinary level indeed. And it also underlines what a hugely complex an expensive undertaking hosting an America's Cup has become. I'm finding it hard to believe that the Irish Exchequer will ever support this kind of expenditure. It just seems to me to be a real outlier thing to be doing in this day and age. But maybe I'm wrong. It'd be amazing if I was wrong. We were all going to troop off to Cork. You know, Jeddah is there, possibly Spain. I mean, my sort of feeling is that I think we're probably heading back to New Zealand is the most likely outcome. But as I say, I think, you know, Ben spoke a lot about the importance of momentum in the cup, you know, to keep this, you know, one of its strengths is that one of the things that make the cup unique in world sport is that, you know, you don't know when it's going to be, where it's going to be, when it's going to be, and what kind of boats it's going to be in. But actually, at the moment, we're seeing that all of those aspects as weakness, which is no one knows when it's going to be, and we're all fearful that it's going to take a lot longer than had been initially hoped.
I think on the upside of it, the potential for a return of Alinghi is mouthwatering, really, because love him or dislike him, Ernesto Bertarelli is a character in the sport He's he can be controversial. He can be outspoken. He can be cunning, and that's what we need in the cup, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing to have them back. Big hitters with an incredible record. They're going to create some problems. You know, there's still some very, very famous sailors who are not accounted for in terms of where they're going next. Obviously, there's nationality rules that are going to come into play. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, he's got a history in this. He knows exactly what's involved. It will be fantastic to have him back. And, you know, even if it's a small field again, if Alinghi's part of it, it's going to be quality. And so, yeah, I agree. I think it'd be great to see them back.
Yeah, and I think the advent of the new smaller boat for the pre-events worked pretty well. I was involved with the Italian Challenger of Record program from the regatta side of it last time. But I know the team were always very nervous about all of these events in one of the two boats that you're going to take to the America's Cup. And, you know, like it was a big risk to go racing in these highly developed, highly expensive boats. So I think using the smaller boats we'll see more racing, which is what we all want. And maybe it doesn't help us with the form guide particularly, I don't think, because at the end of the day, it all comes down to when they reveal the main boat. But that's the way the America's Cup used to be, right?
Yeah. And I mean, on the form guide and the main boat, I mean, my sort of rather simplistic hope from Ben's point of view is that provided he's got the right intellectual input on the design team, which we've discussed already, you know, you can see things sort of moving in his direction here, which is that, you know, they went through that first cut where both the Americans and the Brits were at a disadvantage because they didn't see the rule for, I can't remember how many months it was, that the Italians and the Kiwis had it. So it was a bit of a game of catch up, and the Brits certainly completely got their first boat wildly wrong, and I think that kind of threw them really. I think if you look back at what went wrong with that, it probably went wrong from the moment they got their first boat wrong, because then that influenced the second boat, and they went a bit probably too far on the second boat, and they weren't able to get that boat, you know, to maximize its potential and so on. And but this time you can sort of say, okay, it's the second generation of this class. There are going to be some changes, but not too many. And you really think, okay, he's got a chance now because he knows what the game is. He's starting from the same point that everyone else is. And Ben completely understands that it's design, 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 design. So, yeah, if it happens, God, you know, we're saying if, because how long is it going to take? It might not be till 2025 or even 26, I've heard people saying. I mean, to me, that would be an absolute disaster. But let's really keep our fingers crossed that it stays on track. We get it in 2024 and that Ben has got a boat that, you know, finally they can really go and take it to the Kiwis.
Now, in the meantime, we've got SailGP to keep us entertained. Do we love SailGP?
Well, I ought to, and there are things about it that I love, but there are also things about it that really irritate me. And you know,
tell me.
Well, I think it is a great league, and you know, we're incredibly lucky that someone like Larry Ellison has put so much money on the table for this, and these boats are incredible, but it still struggles quite a lot as a sporting property to keep its head above water in comparison to whatever else is going on a Sunday and is fighting for space in Monday's paper. And I've sort of been asking myself a bit that question, is why is it not an absolute automatic shoe-in for good coverage every Monday? I think it's very easy to criticize the format, but without having constructive alternative suggestions, and that's where I'm very weak. I don't have the answers, but I sort of sometimes feel, I don't know if you've ever thought this, that when innovative sporting properties are being developed in sailing, I think it would be quite good occasionally to have a sports journalist on the board, in the room, Just to sort of get a feel from their point of view, how does this look? You know, do you think this is going to work? You know, is it going to be compelling from a sporting narrative point of view? You know, what's the key attributes that will get this in, whether it's on, you know, radio, TV, online or in papers? And I don't know whether SailGP did that. I mean, SailGP has slightly the same problems as its forerunner, the Extreme Sailing Series, which is it feels a bit more like a rodeo, you know, a kind of Harlem Globetrotters show than a serious sporting event. It just feels like that. It's got this sort of, it's more spectacular than serious a lot of the time. I think this year they've had uncommon bad luck with light airs, which has made even these F-50s look a bit dull. When the breeze was blowing, which I think we saw in the last event, it was amazing. I mean, the speed.
It was.
But I think just to go back to from the purely sporting point of view, one of the central problems is that you have all these tiny little races and it's really difficult to see where the key moments are. You know, what is the moment when you think, you know, because the whole point about sporting, I think, whether it's cricket, football, rugby, whatever, you tend to look for, you know, that key moment when something was won and lost. And I just feel like it would be good to really look again at the structure of it. Maybe not have all the prize money just on the very end of the season, which seems a long, long, long way away for most of the season. You know, have them give them something more to race for each weekend. Perhaps have less itty bitty races and maybe some slightly longer ones where there's a bit more meat in it. And I know they're bringing in a couple of extra boats, so that will definitely help. The other thing is maybe have one-on-one racing where it's knocking out, you know, you get into a knockout phase because you want to see losers. You know, people got to remember this, you know, winning is about losers as well. And that's what makes it so painful and so joyous. But on the other side of SailGP, there are just a couple of points I would make is their decision to go with kilometres an hour, I think, is an absolute. It pisses me off.
Agreed.
And the sooner they change that. If you want to appeal, if you want people who don't know anything about an area of human life and you want to get them interested, I think the last thing you do is make it seem like everything else. You actually want to show them what's different about it and encourage them to be interested in and want to explore it because it's different. And it's not, I mean, kilometres an hour is an absolutely ridiculous decision. And the sooner they scrap that, the better. Every time I watch SailGP online, the column on the comments side on YouTube is just full of people saying, when are they going to get rid of? Yeah. And the other thing is all the greenwashing that goes on, which we, as journalists, we get subjected to, but none of us report any of that. I haven't seen very much reporting of the green side of it. My feeling is that in the current world we live in, we are all painfully aware that we're operating in a climate crisis, and everyone who's doing anything that involves potentially harmful activity to this planet needs to be offsetting and doing everything they can to mitigate those effects. But just do it. There's no need to tell us about it. We expect you to be doing it. Just do it. And, you know, maybe show us on your website a place to look for it if we want to see the detail. But, you know, bombarding us with endless press releases about how green it is, I don't know what kind of return they get on that sort of stuff. Probably they'll tell us.
Yeah, they'll win an award for it for sure, whatever it is. I agree. I think it's difficult for all of them because they feel that you know, events like SailGP feel they need to be promoting the green side of sailing. But I think, yeah, they may be pushing it down people's throats a little too hard. I would agree with you. I think the point to make, though, is that we want SailGP to succeed. All of us, everybody in the sport of sailing wants it to succeed because, you know, Larry's put his money where his mouth is and he's a much maligned character, but, you know, he's our billionaire and he's stuck with sailing for a long time when he could have been off putting more money into tennis or any of the other sports that he's interested in. So,
yeah, no, I totally agree. I completely agree with you, Justin. And I also think that, as I mentioned, I think they've had this season, they've had a lot of bad luck with the weather, which has given the series a slightly downbeat feel, which is unfortunate. I think when the breeze blows, it all just lights up.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the last Sunday in Cadiz was you know, I had sweaty palms just watching it. But even, you know, to be fair, even the light hours days, they raced, you know, whereas in the old days, I remember sitting in Nice day after day of no racing because the monohull lead mines couldn't, you know, couldn't generate any forward motion. So I think they're in a good place to capitalize it. I feel like they try a little bit too hard. You know, I think the commentators, they need to take the reins off the commentators and let them relax a little bit.
You know, I feel like it's being oversold. You feel constantly we're being told that things which are, you know, reasonably interesting and exciting are unbelievably exciting and ridiculously interesting. And actually, let's just let it speak for itself a bit more. I think would be better. But I can see, there's obviously a lot of pressure on them to, you know, deliver hype.
Yeah, for sure. And I think they need to stop that because both of those commentators, Freddie Carr and Stevie Morrison, are, you know, technically great. They know their sport. They've both competed at the highest level. And just let them commentate on it the way that, you know, they let John McEnroe talk about tennis.
I agree.
Not every race is the best race ever. Not every tennis match is the most exciting ever. And I think they would do better for that. That's our opinion on it. We're coming to the end of our session. I didn't want to go without talking about the big news this week. Alex Thompson's, what are we going to call it? He's not retired from ocean racing. He said he might be back one race after the next one, but fundamentally, Hugo Boss have ended their sponsorship, so Alex isn't going to be on the start line of the next race. This is big news. He's been at this a long time, and you must have covered a lot of Alex's career.
Yeah, well, he first came to prominence in a I think it was a Clipper race, 1998, which was sponsored by the Times, funnily enough. So we took an uncommon interest in that race, and he won it. And I think that's when he sort of, really made his mark. And he went on from there to getting into the Open 60 class, as was. It's Alex's career has been it's been pretty mind blowing. I mean, there's been a kind of cocktail of success, some success, and an amazing amount of accidents, reverses, misfortunes, you know, to a degree which is just hard to believe that one man can attract so much adverse fate, if you like. I think to start off, what everyone has got to remember, and you just got to scream this from the rooftop, is that Alex Thompson podium twice in the Vendée Globe, second and third. I mean, that is phenomenal. He didn't achieve his ultimate dream, which was to become the first Briton, the first non-French winner of the Vendée Globe. But my God, you know, he came close. And I think the fact that he's done it twice puts him in a class of his own as far as British skippers are. I think that puts him ahead of Ellen and puts him ahead of Mike Golding. But at the same time, you know, you cannot help but feel what ifs and if onlys. And, you know, there was always this issue with Alex is, you know, was he pushing his boats too hard? And, you know, were a lot of the things that went wrong really a result of that as much as, you know, some things were completely out of his control? And I think there was a little bit. I mean, my feeling about Alex is he, you know, he's not an Olympic sailor. He never did the Figaro. And I always had this kind of feeling that he sort of slightly had, not an inferiority complex, but felt like he had to have the fastest boat if he was going to beat, you know, the likes of Charlie Dallin and, you know, all the Armel Leclerc and all these people who've come from this incredible kind of discipline in France. And it felt to me often that he was constantly developing boats to a very high level, but they were really on the edge in terms of their durability. And when you combine that with his tendency to just thrash the hell out of them, we saw this in the last Vendée Globe where he just went straight into the middle of a tropical storm off Madeira. He wasn't the only one who did it. But I mean, to my mind, that just looked pretty crazy thing to do when you're talking about around the world race. You know, absolutely the most important thing was to get to the equator in one piece, and he got to the equator in quite a few pieces. It's very frustrating. And Alex has been a great communicator, but at the same time, he's set his face for long periods against the French. He's become, he was always on the other side of the channel. Obviously I'm involved with Imoca at the moment, so I'm very aware that he hasn't been taking part in Imoca events, and he's very much seen as an outsider. And in some ways that put more pressure on him, I think, than was warranted. But if you look at the last few years, it's just been an extraordinary run. You know, he had that disaster in the Transat Jacques-Vabre where they lost the keel, him and Neil MacDonald. Then he had the most heartbreaking, he never won a race in the Imoca class. And he came within a few hours of doing so in the Route de Rome and then fell asleep and hit Guadeloupe. It was like being hit in the solar plexus. I haven't spoken to Alex, but I think, even his bounce back ability, he was like a boxer who kept getting back up off the canvas. I think maybe that Route de Rome and then what happened in the Vendée Globe just took the wind out of him. That's probably what I think's happened. I think it's a real pity. Hugo Boss have spent millions of euros on him. And it is a pity that he hasn't been able to pass on that commercial relationship to someone else.
But that isn't to say that they didn't get a return on those millions, because I don't know whether they did or they didn't, but they were with him for a long time. So I guess it must have been working for them. And he's been criticized for the stunts that they did, the mast walk and the keel walk and all of that good stuff. And I sent this to you just before the podcast. This was sent to me last night. Brad Van Loo, a message to Alex Thompson on, I think, Facebook, about his kind of withdrawal from ocean racing. He says, as it should be, at the end of the day, you need to win races to earn sponsorships, and you never win. Jumping off masts and playing stunts is just a stunt. You were a lucky winner of the best sponsorship ever and squandered it.
Yeah, well,
seems a little harsh to me.
Yeah, I don't go along with that at all. I mean, I think actually, we talked earlier about Ellen MacArthur bringing sailing to a wider audience. I think Alex did a pretty good job of that himself with some pretty innovative and fun. None of these French guys have done anything like that. I mean, I thought it was great. I mean, and if it was bringing new eyes to that part of sailing, then all to the good. And I think to say that he didn't win races, I mean, Alex is the first person to say, I didn't win races. But my God, he tried. I mean, he tried in his own way. Maybe there were some weaknesses in the way he went about it, which we've discussed. But my God, he didn't. You can't say he didn't apply himself. And it's not easy to win the Vendée Globe. And to come second and third, it's not easy to do that either. But for a twist of fate, he could easily have won that race. So, I think that's harsh.
Yeah, I think it's harsh. And also, I think a lot of the stunts were driven by the sponsor themselves. It wasn't that Alex was out there saying, oh, this here, we'll spend a bit more money and we'll do this. Those stunts were sophisticated setups that were, that Alex wouldn't have access to the facilities to do that without Hugo Boss getting involved and their creative people getting involved for sure. A little tough. So what do we think next for Alex? Will we see him kind of play the Mer concept kind of approach? Is he gonna nurture some new sailors? There's talk of Sam Goodchild. I saw that you wrote that the other day.
Yeah, I mean, he said, he wants to now move into a kind of management role. I guess Francois Gabart is the kind of model for that. Or Michetej is another one who's done it. And Armel Leclerc is doing it as well. I mean, I think it's quite interesting to see how he might develop into that. We haven't seen him, it's all been about Alex up until now. As he said, I've been the front and center of this whole thing. Now I want to take a step back. He's talked about his family and so on. But it'll be very interesting. I mean, he's had the oxygen of all this money flowing from Germany for the last 18 years, and suddenly that's turned off. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how he copes where the money isn't flowing, and he's going to have to go and get that money. That's the first huge challenge, because, you know, you can manage anyone all you like, but if there's no budget, there's no boat and there's no race. So, yeah, I mean, I hope he can leverage his position, as they say, and help a young sailor get a sponsor, get the right boat build, get the right design package, and then give them a chance to do what he was trying to do. And as you say, Sam Goodchild's a name that's been mentioned. I'm not sure if that's going to be the one, but, you know, let's see what happens. But it's, you know, quite interesting in Mocha Fleet at the moment, because the Brits have got, you know, we've got Sam Davis now, who's getting a new Sam Manoir boat. That'll be interesting to see how well Sam goes with that, which we'll see that in the next Route de Rhum, and then the next Vendée Globe. You know, she's always been in inferior machinery, so this is really the moment of truth for her. And then obviously we've got the amazing Pip Hare, who's going to be racing within racing, but to a higher level with her new Medallia. And actually, in the last couple of days, she's been out practicing in the Western Approaches. It's been quite interesting just following her on AIS and seeing where she's been going. I have to say, I'm quite amazed. She's been out on a training sail on a new boat in very congested waters, on her own, as far as I can tell. You know, a lot of fishing boats, lots of commercial traffic, TSSs to go around, bits of land all over the place. Not easy time, not an easy way to spend 5 days sailing on your own in terms of getting sleep and so on. I'm quite interested to see how she's coped with that.
This is the great thing about the Vendée Globe and why it's so exciting. There are, for a journalist, there are just stories everywhere, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, I think Pip's phenomenal. I mean, she's an incredible communicator, absolutely. And what amazes me, I actually checked this. She is 47, and Ellen retired when she was 33. I mean, Pip is sort of taking off on her. I'm not saying she's going to go and win the Vendée Globe, because I don't think she's got the kit. But the fact is, she's going to give it a real good go next time round. And, you know, she's doing this years after Ellen would have retired. So, I mean, that girl has got real, you know, a real drive. It's very impressive to see. And I love the way she talks to us. She's a great, you know, she's very much like Ellen in that way. You feel like you're with her on board, and she has no, she's not trying to pretend she's anything other than who she is. I think it's great.
Well, Pip's promised that she's going to be a guest on the podcast in November when her schedule allows. She's, as you say, very busy. And I get that going sailing is more important than talking to the likes of me. But I'm really looking forward to having her on in November. For you now, the next big thing is you're off to Le Havre for the start of the Jacques Vabre. That's a milestone event, isn't it, in offshore sailing? And looks like an absolute classic this time around. Are you going to be following? The Mocha class, I guess.
Yeah, I'll be focusing on the Mochas, and also keep an eye on Sam Goodchild, who's going to start favourite in the multi-50s. That could be his last race before he, you know, all the rumours are he's moving into the Mocha class. Yeah, for the Amokas, it's the climax of the two-handed season, and as we mentioned before, Charlie Dannan and Paul Meyer on Apivia are going to be the boat to beat. They've won everything in the last few months. They sailed an absolutely immaculate fastnet race. Then they won the Defi 48 hours, so they'll be watched. But the other one that's very interesting is the older 11th Hour, which is the old Hugo Boss, which is sailed by Simon Fischer and Justine Metrault of Switzerland. And they have been going really nicely on a boat that's properly sorted out. And Sci-Fi is he's coming into this part of sailing, bringing great experience and skill. And I think he's absolutely loving every minute of it. So I'm expecting to see them do, again, at very least on the podium, but they could win it if something, if Apivia doesn't have a great race. And then we've also got Jeremy Bayou and Christopher Pratt on Chiral. They've got a point to prove. Their boat's just come out of the shed after some damage that they had on the fastnet race. And there's the brand new 11th Hour, which is called Malama, which is being sailed by Charlie Enright and Pascal Bidegory. And, you know, that is a potent weapon. All the rumours are that they they're actually struggling to control the power in that boat.
Yeah.
And the question is, can they actually get it along the course without it breaking down? I mean, I think it would be a great achievement if they get to the finish. It's a long course, 5,800 miles. They go down to Fernando de Noronha off the Brazilian coast, and then back up to the finish at Martinique. And it's, you know, there's two crossings of the doldrums, so it's going to be a pretty full on. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be great.
It is. It's going to be exciting. And we've got the Ultims and the Class 40s also racing in that. So there's plenty to watch. Where can we see your output?
Well, I'll be covering, I'm hoping the times are going to, you know, get stuck in on the TJV. So I think we've got, you know, Sam Davis is there as well, and with Nico Luvan in their last, that'd be her last race in the old Initiatives Cur. We haven't really talked about her, but she's a phenomenon in her own way. So obviously Sam in the 50s. So yeah, so I hope the times will get involved in that. But I'll also be covering it for Imoca, doing their English language communication side of it.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with that. And thank you so much for spending the time. It's an hour and a half we've been talking now. I think we said there was going to be plenty to talk about, but it's been pretty interesting stuff as far as I'm concerned. So Ed, thank you so much, and good luck with the Transat Vab, and let's keep in touch, and maybe we'll do this again in the new year once we know where we are with the America's Cup.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Sincere thanks to Ed Gorman for such a great interview, and thanks as always to all of you for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, as usual, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.